Hey there, it's Frank Buckley. My guest today is a great comic and a great guy whose work you've seen on Saturday Night Live, where he was a cast member, and on other TV shows and in the movies. It's Kevin Nealon, who has a terrific show now on YouTube. It's called Hiking with Kevin. Kevin goes on hikes with famous friends, and they chat about all sorts of things. We have a link to it on the Frank Buckley Interviews podcast page if you want to check it out right now. And we'll show you some clips from the show on Frank Buckley Interviews when it airs this weekend on KTLA 5. Kevin really opens up during this conversation, and if you're a fan like me, I think you're going to enjoy his behind-the-scenes stories from Saturday Night Live and the stories from Kevin's life, including two very important phone calls that changed the course of his career. One of the calls was from the actor Dana Carvey. The other was a crossroads moment phone call that Kevin had with his dad. Here's my conversation with Kevin Nealon. Please finish your drink.
No, thank you. If I could just get a check from the waitress.
Congratulations on Hiking with Kevin.
Thank you.
I mean, the third season.
Third season, which I've created. I've created the seasons. I've decided, you know, when I first started doing it, there wasn't seasons. It was right. Just like, I like doing this. I'll do another one. I'll do another one. And then I'm up to like 31 hikes. I'm thinking, I should end this sometime, take a break, can some hikes so I'm not going week to week trying to find somebody, you know, and that's what I did. I said, okay, that'll be season one, 31 hikes. And then I did season two last year, 31 hikes. And then this year, I've already done 11 hikes. I have them in the can, but I'm thinking, do I want to do 31 again? That's a lot of hikes, you know, maybe 21 this year.
Right.
You know, so yeah, season three.
And when you started this, it wasn't like, I'm going to do a show. It was just you and...
It was very organic, Frank. I just, you know, I called Matthew Modine, the actor. He's a friend of mine. I said, hey, Matt, you want to go for a hike? He goes, sure. So he comes up to my house. It was near Temescal Canyon. And we hike up the canyon, and we're both so out of breath. We're winded near the top. It was a really good hike. And we're talking, you know, and I thought, this would really be funny if this were an interview show. And I was, you know, asking him questions he could barely understand because I was out of breath. And he's answering. He's out of breath. And so I videotaped that. And it was really funny. And then on the way down, I asked him some serious questions. I said, Matt, you ever turned down anything you regretted, like in your career? And he rolled his eyes. He goes, oh, man, after Full Metal Jacket, it was such a hit. I was turning down things left and right that I regretted. I turned down Back to the Future, the Michael J. Fox role, Wall Street, the Charlie Sheen role, Hanks' role in Big, and Tom Cruise in Top Gun. Turned down all those.
No,
I said, you
didn't.
Idiot.
He turned down the Tom Cruise role?
Yeah. I said, you idiot. And we both laughed, and I had it recorded, and I just played that on Instagram and on Twitter, you know, and that's all I had. It was just 2-minute interstitials, you know, quick little things. I did maybe a 3-parter, 2 minutes each on Twitter and a minute on Instagram. And then I found out that Howard Stern was a fan of that, and he goes, you ought to make that a longer segment, like, you know, 15, 20 minutes. So that's a good idea. I'm going to have to start a YouTube channel and get into all that stuff. And I never knew how to do any of that stuff, you
right.
know. And so I learned how to do YouTube. I learned how to, you know, edit. And I learned how to fly a drone. I bought a drone because I do aerial shots now.
Oh, you weren't kidding when you said the drone. You actually do a drone.
I do a drone. And then, you know, the YouTube stuff. And now I'm doing subtitles. I'm learning that. And it's all about, and Photoshop. I got Photoshop. I'm working with that now. It's a whole new language.
I mean, don't take this wrong the way, but it seems to me that in some ways doing all this is beneath you. And I don't know how to say that without you taking that
the
wrong way.
Well, Frank, everything's beneath me.
No, but you're a big star. And, you know, you spending all your time editing and putting subtitles and
you're right.
doing all this stuff.
You're right.
You know.
Pay the man.
Exactly.
You know what my grandfather said on his deathbed? He said his only regret, if he had to do it over again, he would pay people to do stuff because he cut his own grass all the time. He fixed everything.
Yeah.
You know, he was a hard worker. And I always think about that, you know, and I do that like around the house. Like I won't lift a finger around the house. I pay people to come over and lift my finger for me. but because this is such an artistic kind of a endeavor,
yeah.
I kind of like to have a hands-on approach to it, especially with the editing, because I think that's half the comedy.
Yeah.
You know, the hike is one thing, the interview, but then the way you put it together, I mean, that's another element, another layer of comedy. Now, the you know, the subtitles and stuff and all the art design and stuff, I should be able to farm that out to somebody else, and I will. I need to, otherwise I'll have no life. I'll have an hour hike a week and then no other life.
You don't have a life right now because you are exhausted as we're sitting here. I mean, I could tell you.
I'm only tired of looking at you. No, I'm
get in line.
I was up last night trying to do the subtitle thing,
yeah,
and doing some last minute art design on you know, the title cards on my little hiking show, because I have some new things going on this year, you know, freshening it up a little bit. And I was up to like 2 o'clock trying to do the subtitle thing. It was so frustrating. And then I had to drive my son to the bus stop this morning. I got up at 5:30 to wake him up and get him breakfast going, you know. And I need to get a staff to do that. I need a staff to do the breakfast and drive him to the – and just to raise him completely.
Right.
And let me just sleep.
But here's the thing. I think it's fantastic that you're doing these things. And tell me if I'm wrong, but I found that doing these kinds of interviews, where you sit down with someone and talk for 20 minutes or a half an hour or an hour, that it's just better than the stuff that I'm sure you're used to doing, right? You come on our show, for example, the morning news.
Well, yeah.
You do 3 or 4 minutes. We love having you. It's great. But there isn't this sort of like a deeper connection that happens. But when you spend time with somebody, it happens. People open up.
These are great. And that's like the hike, too. I get to be with someone for an hour on a trail outside in the wilderness.
Yeah.
And I don't even know some of these people. And they trust me. They go out into the woods with me. And they never know. If I ever take like a path off to the side that's a little like, you know, heavy growth, every time, invariably, they'll say, "Is this where you whack me?" Because that's what everybody's thinking. But yeah, this is much better. And I love doing the show with you guys in the morning, but it is kind of a drive-by. You know, it's kind of you talk a little bit, you promote your thing, and then you're gone.
Yeah.
But this, you could kind of like, you know, really have a decent conversation.
Right.
If you were sober.
Of these wonderful conversations you've had, are there some that sort of have stuck in your mind where you've thought, wow, I didn't know that about that person, or that really, you know, where they opened up in a way that maybe you weren't expecting?
Yeah, of course. Yeah, there's a lot of surprises. That's what I love about it. I went hiking with Conan O'Brien, and he was very revealing about how anxiety runs in his family, you know, and depression. And just, you know, I hiked with Kate Beckinsale, who I didn't know really, you know, but I thought I knew she was, you know, a beautiful actress, and she was British, and she was very down to earth and funny, really funny.
Yeah.
You know, and naughty. Yeah.
You had Al Franken on recently.
Al Franken, yeah.
And I know you guys did SNL together a million years ago, but, you know, he's gone on to become U.S. Senator and then had the issue that left him, you know, out of office.
Yeah.
And when you talk about that, things like that, with an old pal, it must be easier because you have that sort of relationship going in.
It is. It is easy. And it's also, you have to kind of be aware that you don't want to get too reminiscent about, you know, things you went through, because then you exclude the audience. You know,
yeah.
You become more like, you know, remember that time when that gum was stuck on the doorknob, and and the audience was like, oh, who cares? You know?
Right. I think the audience likes stuff like that.
They do, to a certain extent. Like, I hiked with Alec Baldwin, and, you know, we talked a good deal of time about how we both used to be quarterbacks. He was in high school, quarterback. I was in college, a quarterback. And when he was hosting SNL, we would love to get in the hallway outside the writer's room. You know, it's about half the size of this room, the hallway. Ceilings like that. We were too tall to throw the football. I had a football up there. So we spread about like 30 yards apart in the hallway, and we get on our knees and we throw the ball as hard as we could to each other, and we couldn't move. We had to catch it and then throw it from our knees. And that's, he remembered that. And that was like over 30 years ago.
Wow.
Or 25 years ago.
Yeah.
And, but little moments like that, when you know somebody, is fun to kind of reminisce about and bring up. And then people that I don't know, it's fun to find out about them and what they do and what, you know, what they like, what annoys their spouse, you know, you know, have they been arrested, you know, things like that.
And do you put a lot of time into thinking, what am I going to ask this person? Or is it all sort of organic? You're just walking and start talking.
A lot of it's walking, talking. I do have some questions in my pocket, especially if I don't know the person that well, to go to if I need to. But mostly the thing about hiking outside, and why I think it's a great venue, as it were, to do an interview, is because there's no audience. There's nobody looking right at you. We're both looking ahead, looking at the trail, looking at people going by us.
Right.
So it's very relaxing. And when I hike alone, even, I love to meditate and write. Mm. It's such a creative period for me, because I don't know what it is, the endorphins or just the relaxing of being outside.
Yeah.
And, you know, the shade, the sun, the wind. And you're getting exercise, and I just feel I'm in such a better mood when I come back.
Are there particular routes that you like in the LA area?
There are some hikes. You know, now when I book a guest to be on my show, I kind of categorize them. They're either a flatliner, you know, which means they got to stay on the flat trails, and they require that. David Spade, for example, is a flatliner.
Completely out of shape.
Yeah, and okay. We were going along the flat, and he stopped, and he goes, are we going uphill? It's like a 1% grade, and he spotted it. And then other people are like in really great shape. I find a lot of women are in better shape than guys for hiking, and they hike more, I think, than guys. Or Molly Shannon was a great hiker. Okay. Chelsea Handler.
And they also sort of withstand pain a little bit better, I think, than men. We tend to complain.
Well, I don't hit them.
Right.
Oh, we're just hiking.
No, I'm just talking about the pain threshold.
Yeah. No, they do definitely. I think women have a much higher threshold of pain than men.
Yeah. Talking about Saturday Night Live and reminiscing about Saturday Night Live, we loved you on Saturday Night Live. And
thank you.
So many wonderful characters that you created. I always think about Hans and Franz. And you did that with Dana Carvey.
Yeah.
And what I didn't realize until I read about this, Dana was instrumental in you even being on the show.
He was. I lived in a house in Hollywood Hills with two other comics. One of them was actually a writer. He has passed away. And the other one was Bob Dubeck, great comic, magician. And then Dana would come down from San Francisco whenever he was in L.A., and he rented the room above our garage in the Hollywood Hills. It was a nice little Spanish house. And we were friends, and I've known Dana for a long time. We worked the clubs together. We actually ran together around the Hollywood Reservoir a lot. And we'd stand out in the driveway and kind of jamming ideas. And I was a stand-up, you know, and he was great. He was a sketch player. You know, he knew how to do impressions and characters. And he got selected to be on SNL. This was back in the 1900s. And he went off to New York, and I was so happy for him. I was excited for him. I knew somebody that was going to be on Saturday Night Live. I felt really, you know, proud. And about 3 weeks after he left that summer for that coming fall, I get a call from him. He goes, Kev, it's Dana. I'm out at Lorne Michaels' house in Long Island. Guess who's in the kitchen? Bill Murray and Dan Aykroyd. I said, no way. He goes, yeah. Bill Murray and Dan Aykroyd in the kitchen. He goes, no. Anyway, Lorne Michaels, the producer, is looking for one more cast member. And I told him about you, and he might want to see your tapes. I said, Bill Murray and Dan Aykroyd are really in the kitchen? I wasn't even hearing that other stuff because I knew I'd never get on that show because I didn't do sketches or characters or accents. I was just a stand-up, a really, really good stand-up.
Right.
But I sent my tapes, and, you know, what would it hurt? 2 weeks later, I get another call. Yeah. It's Dana. I'm back out at Lorne Michaels' house in Long Island. Guess who's in the kitchen? Steve Martin. No, Steve Martin's in the kitchen. Yeah. Anyway, Lorne liked your tapes. I think they're going to fly you in for an audition. I said, Steve Martin's really in the kitchen. So I fly into New York. It's a free trip to New York. That's all I'm thinking. I'm showing up. I go to Studio 8H up in 30 Rockefeller Plaza. I'd never been there before. I walk into the Studio 8H. It looks a lot smaller. I get tired all of a sudden when I'm in there because I always fell asleep watching that show, the original years, you know? So there's like a kind of a, you know.
It's a trigger.
Yeah. And I do my little audition. It was just a little stand-up of what I did and a little bit of what Dane and I, you know, we jam on some ideas in the driveway of our house, but nothing really, formulated. And I fly home and, you know, I forget about it. Like most auditions, you do them and you forget about them and sometimes they call you.
So let me just stop you for a second. You go in for this audition and you're like, your heart's not beating out of your chest. You're not sweating.
I was the only one, Frank, not nervous because I knew I'd never get it.
Really?
I thought this is like, I felt like George Plimpton, you know, I was just kind of, but the other people to this day, I know who some of them were and fantastic sketch players. And they probably would have helped the show a lot more than I did. And they were nervous though, because they had a shot at it, you know? So I fly back home and 2 weeks later, I get a call. Or actually, 2 weeks later, I find myself sitting in front of Lorne Michaels in a high-rise in Beverly Hills, the producer, and he's offering me a job on SNL. I said, let me think about it over the weekend, Lorne.
No, you
That's
didn't.
The way I roll, baby.
No, you didn't.
I work it, man.
Did
I
mean, you really?
How do you think I got here on your show? I worked it, baby. I worked it. He said, well, you think about it over the weekend. We'll see you in New York on Monday. So the next thing you know, I'm at Lorne Michaels' house in Long Island, and I got a call from Dana. He goes, Kev, guess what? I'm back out at Lorne Michaels' house. Guess who's in the kitchen? I said, I'm in the kitchen now, tough guy. I'm in the kitchen. Full circle.
Wow.
Yeah. So that was it. And I remember the first sketch I did on there, I wasn't nervous because when we took over that show or when we came on that show, the year before, they almost canceled the show because the ratings were so low.
Mm.
Great Ooh. Actors on there, Robert Downey Jr., Anthony Michael Hall, but there was no synergy. You need to have the synergy between the writers and the cast for that thing to work, and the talent on both sides. And we had that with ours because Lorne hired a lot of friends that we knew each other. I knew Dana, you know, I knew Dennis Miller. I was dating Jan Hooks at the time, and I'd been friends with her for a long time. And so I remember right before I did my first sketch, it was called Mr. Subliminal. So it was like you know, inserting subliminal ideas in the conversation. And I'm thinking about it, but I'm pretending that nobody's watching the show anymore. That's how I got through it. You know, we do little games to psych ourselves out, you know, to psych ourselves up to get through situations. And I thought, you know, I'm used to an audience like this because I play comedy club stand-up. And these cameras, nobody's watching this show. And then Lorne comes up to me, coming out of commercial, 5 seconds away. He puts his hand on my shoulder and he goes, "Are you sure this is what you want?" So, you know, but it was a great ride. You know, I loved doing it. I wasn't looking for that show to be a stepping stone. I just enjoyed being there because I never thought I'd be there. It happened so quickly. Within 3 days, I was in New York. I didn't even have time to tell my friends.
And then it was 9 seasons.
9 years I stayed there because I loved it.
Yeah.
I love being, you know, the immediacy of it. I love the spontaneity of it, the, you know, the live situation. And to work with, you know, these icons that I grew up watching, music-wise and, you know, actor-wise. I got to meet Mick Jagger and Paul McCartney and Paul Simon, James Taylor, you know, Aerosmith, all those people.
The one part of the show that I've always wondered about is the credits shot, the goodbye shot.
Right? I hated that.
I was going to ask.
I hated that.
It seemed always a little awkward.
I tried to hide, and it was so important for Lorne that everybody's out there, and usually his assistants would come and find me because you have to be out there. So I'd go out there and I'd stand in the back. But some people really kind of were aggressive with the goodnights. They'd try to get out front and stand next to the host. And you know, I thought, and sometimes you weren't even in the show that much or on the show at all. And you're out there like, you know. But
then,
I get it. I get it.
And then you hug, people hug each other.
Yeah, hugging the people that have been so competitive against you all week. You know. It was a quiet competitiveness there, though. You know, everybody's, you know, there's a certain amount of pies. You know, time-wise to get on that show for your sketch. So everybody's vying to try to get a piece of that pie. And, you know, when you have a table read, it's awkward because you're, you know, people are reading their sketches and you want them to do well, but you want yours to do well too and better so yours gets on. So there's a lot of fake laughs going on.
Oh.
Kind of not so enthusiastic sometimes.
Oh. And so tell me about that. So the show ends on Saturday. Sunday, I assume you guys all sleep.
That's the other thing, you know, a big part of the, you know, the notorious or famous parties after the show. Each cast member had their own limo that Lorne would provide. Each limo, because we had guests, you know, guests would come to the show. I wasn't a big fan of the party after the first year or two, you know. It wasn't really a party. You go to a different restaurant. They never had the same restaurant. You go to the restaurant and you get your own table and your friends would sit there and they'd gawk at everybody. And, you know, you were with these people all week, so, you know, you really want a break.
Right.
And then they bring you your check, and so you pay for all your friends and your table, and then you go home, and now it's like 4:30 in the morning on Sunday, and you just sleep. Oh.
Wow, what a great story. Ruined by your phone.
Yeah, right? Hello? Who's in the kitchen? You're kidding me.
Comedy gold, ladies and
gentlemen.
Bill
Cosby. Dana Carvey, you never know when he's going to call. yeah, so, you know, I get home at like 4:30 in the morning on Sunday, and Sunday's the only day off. So my ideal thing, you know, would be to skip the party. If I didn't have any guests coming in, skip the party, go home, like be in bed like, you know, 1:30. And have all Sunday to relax and go to the park and do whatever.
Yeah.
And then you start it all over again on Monday. And that was the other thing, too. Guests. When you had guests coming to the show, I was more worried about my guests getting in to the show. Did they get in all right? Did they do security? And then working on my lines and, you know, tweaking sketches.
It's crazy the human part of it that, you know, at home we don't think about any of that. You know, we think you're all superstars, you're funny.
Yeah.
You do the show, we enjoy it. But you're trying to live a life.
You're juggling so many things, and you're living in New York, which is a crazy town to live in. You know, a lot of things going on there. And
and
the rents were expensive. You know, you spent all your money on rent.
Right, yeah. When you are preparing for the show, and you talked about that competitive process of pitching stories and all that, is it all, you know, all of you going one after another to Lorne and saying, here's our pitch?
Well, you know, it's funny. on Mondays, you have a very casual light pitch to the host. The host comes in, he sits in front of Lauren's desk in a nice big easy chair. And then we all file in, and the cast got bigger and bigger. So that office became more and more cramped, and Lauren never changed it from there. The office was really about as big as this room. And there was like, 30 people in there, just all crammed in. And each one would go around the room, and, Lauren would go, Dana, you have an idea? Phil, Victoria. And we pitch our ideas, and the host would just sit there, and he's a little uncomfortable. She's uncomfortable, because it's, Saturday Night Live. And I learned not to pitch a real idea, because if you do and nobody laughs, it takes the wind out of your sails.
Yeah.
And nobody really wants to get on board. So I would always pitch the same thing every week to the host. It was the runaway truck ramp. You ever see those on a freeway?
Yeah.
In case the truck loses its brakes, there's a gravel ramp. Well, I thought that would be funny if there was a bar at the end of that. And, the host was the bartender. And a lot of different, frazzled truck drivers coming in. Oh, you gotta have something, And that was my pitch. And I never wrote it up, but it was the same thing every week.
And the host would go, oh, okay.
And
then Lauren writes it down, or does he roll his eyes and say, come on, Kevin, give us a real pitch?
No, he doesn't.
He's just used to hearing it over and over again.
Yeah. On Wednesday we have the table read. So there's a stack of it got more and more as the cast got bigger, because each person writes the writers too, and you read through them, and it takes it would take a couple hours when I was on the first, when we first started, because there's only 8 of us on the cast, and then it became more and more and more. So they would got to a point where there was have to take a break during the table read. It's like 4 hours,
oh,
four and a half
man.
Hours of reading. And if your sketch is at the end, people are exhausted,
Yeah.
They won't get a fair shake. So you read through those all, and then they, everybody adjourns, and Lauren goes to his office with two of the head writers and the host, and they compare what they liked, and then they put the index cards up on the bulletin board of, maybe 10 sketches. And from those 10, they'll lose two, after the rehearsal show for the live show. And then an hour later, you walk in and you look at the board and you don't see your sketch up there. You go, okay, well, maybe next week.
Wow. And then you might get cast in someone else's
sketch.
But you
have to assume that nobody's writing for you, because sometimes they don't. And so you have to write for you and keep yourself covered.
And the recurring characters, would they get an automatic in, or did you have to pitch recurring characters?
Well, if you you wouldn't get an automatic in, because you'd have to, I love the character I did called Mr. No Depth Perception. I wrote this character who had no depth perception, and we would be at a dinner party, and this is the table would be this big, and I would think it was longer. I go, hey Frank, how about that cutie sitting at the end of the table, huh? And you go, she can hear you, she's right there. No, she can't hear me, So I tried to get that one on again, and I just could not get it on, for some reason.
Yeah.
But you do have to write one each time. But, when you have recurring characters like Hans and Franz, people know them now, and more people are writing toward that, and they're adding, and they're helping, or they have ideas. So it's good to get that wave going where you have a hit character.
Yeah. Dana calling you and saying, hey, Lauren's looking for somebody, and him putting you forward for the job, what did that mean to you?
Well, I was totally surprised. And I always wondered, did Dana do that because he didn't want somebody else that was, a better character actor than him on the show? He wanted to throw me in there. But I think he really liked, the truth is I think he liked my sensibility, and he thought, and I think Lauren also said to him, we could use a Chevy Chase type character,
Yeah.
And I loved Chevy Chase, his stand-up. That's why I emulated kind of his style on Weekend Update.
Yeah.
Because that's what I, liked, started off seeing. And, of course, the Weekend Update kind of evolved over the years, and people kind of brought different things to it where it became more of a stand-up sitting there and kind of like commenting on stuff and, not really doing the news per se. Here's another joke, But it's all, everybody likes different styles. But my style was more the dry, straight-on newscaster guy.
Right. What was it like to be part of the national conversation every week?
It was pretty spectacular to have people talking about a joke that you or one of the writers wrote, It's funny, you know, when you see these talk shows, people say, hey, man, that Kimmel did that joke last night, or Fallon did, came up with this joke. But really, it's a writer usually that wrote it, and they're delivering the joke, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
But it was kind of, it was a difficult position. I did that for 3 years after Dennis left it. And I was doing sketches, too, and characters. You know, Dennis was able to focus on the Weekend Update. He did a good job. So I was really juggling a lot of stuff, and it would be so crazy. We'd do the dress rehearsal, and I had written some jokes, and we had a lot of jokes in there, and I would meet with the segment producer in between the rehearsal and live show, and then have to get to the meeting in Lauren's office, you know, and then tweak my sketches. And I would take some jokes out and say, I don't like that one, I don't like that one. And then I'd go and I'd do the live show, you know, the jokes. And then Sunday, you know, I would be laying in bed thinking, wait a minute, he didn't take that joke out. I said, the check out, you know, or he left that one in. And, you know, so it was just a lot. It was a lot on my plate.
Yeah. Do you miss it?
Sometimes I miss it. I don't think I would want to be back in that foxhole again. You know, at the time it was great and I loved it. A lot of people complain about it. You know, it's competitive and it's hard. But if you pace yourself and you treat it as a marathon, it's a great gig. I loved it. I really did. But I missed kind of living in New York City. I miss the live show thing.
Right.
Okay, it's time to commit. 2024 is the year for prioritizing yourself. Begin your new smile journey with Byte, and you could start seeing results in just 2 to 3 weeks. Just order your at-home impression kit today for only $14.95 at Byte.com. Byte Clear Aligners are doctor-directed and delivered to your door. Treatment costs thousands less than braces. Plus, they offer financing options, accept eligible insurance, and you can pay with your HSA, FSA. Get 80% off your impression kit when you use code WONDERY at Byte.com. That's BYTE.com. Start your confidence journey today with Byte.
You mentioned Howard Stern a moment ago. He loves you.
He seems to love me now.
Yeah.
You know what happened, Frank? About 5 years ago, 6 years ago, I woke up and I thought, I want to start doing things that scare me. You know, I want to start pushing a little bit. Mm. And two of the things that scared me, the shows, was doing the Howard Stern Show and Bill Maher. You know, real
Why?
Time. Because, well, first of all, Howard always made fun of SNL and people on it.
But he loved, I mean, he has a deep respect for SNL.
I think he changed. But if you listen back to him back in the, you know, the 80s, in the 90s.
He was critical.
He was very critical. Mm-hmm. And I think, and he said this himself, it's because he was insecure, you know. But I think he's really kind of matured a lot in the last, I don't know, decade or two. And he's really a great interviewer. And we really hit it off. And it's funny because whenever I'd be in the car listening to that show and he started talking about SNL, I would turn it off. Because I didn't want to hear him bashing me or bashing somebody else. But now, I listen to it all the time, and I love the guy, and we always have a fun time when I go on the show. Yeah. I remember going to do it for the first time. A lot of things don't make me nervous, but that would kind of made me nervous, and I was prepared for anything. But there was such a respect there. I think he has respect for comics in general.
Yeah.
And I walked out of there afterwards floating on cloud nine. I hadn't done that since I did The Tonight Show with Johnny Carson, you know, when I was first got into the business.
It was at that level for you to go on Howard Stern.
Yeah, because I was doing something that I was uncomfortable doing. And the same with the Bill Maher. Real time.
Why did Bill Maher make it?
Because I'm not a political pundit. I had to bone up on all that stuff.
Yeah.
And then I went in there and I got really lucky for like two or three times, you know. I had a lot of good stuff, and I think maybe the last show I was not as good as the last time, and I haven't been back. I don't know if that was my choice or their choice, but.
And why did you say you did these shows? Because you wanted to sort of do something that
I needed to wake myself up, because I was kind of dead inside. Nothing really. I didn't get nervous on stage anymore. You know, I felt like I wasn't. I didn't have that venom. You know, I didn't have that spark anymore. I was just kind of going through the motions. And so I needed to go off that high board.
Why? Why do you have to have
So I feel alive. Venom? You know, you feel alive that way. I mean, what do you do to make yourself excited?
All sorts of things. I mean, this is one of them.
You cook.
To be honest with you.
I
mean,
yeah,
to
no,
be honest
I know.
With
yeah,
you,
just
because,
fun.
You know, I have to prepare for each one of them.
You do.
And it, to me, is a chance to connect with someone. And it's funny, when I do these interviews, I will later replay it in my head and go, wow, I really screwed that up. I already feel like the top of this interview was not great. On my
I thought the middle was kind of weak,
right,
too,
on my
and
end,
also the end.
I really enjoyed the SNL part of the conversation. Yeah. I don't know where it's going to go from here, but I will spend time criticizing
No,
myself.
I get it. I get it, because I'll watch these hikes I do, especially the earlier ones,
yeah,
where I didn't have my interviewing technique down. Well, and I would be interrupting people left and right. If you watch the Conan O'Brien one, I did two with him, but I interrupt him so many times. You can see him going, okay.
I sometimes end up over-preparing. So I will, you know, like if it's an author, I'll read the book. I will read other books. And I think that I will probably be over-prepared. And so then I come off as trying to sound like a smart guy instead of letting the person talk. I mean, do you ever...
Listening is really important.
Yeah.
I mean, I've kind of learned that over the years. It's listening. Even if you have something really, you know, interesting to say, you just hold it and, you know...
Yeah, and honestly, they're not here to listen to me or see me. They're here to listen to you and to see you.
Yeah.
I mean, do you have anything to say?
No, I'm listening. I'm listening. But this is good for you, too, because when you're out on that desk, you don't really get a chance to do this. It's
exactly.
Just a couple of quick, you know...
Right.
Pretending you're happy out there, and you know that whole thing.
pretending like you're being funny.
Yeah.
When you went into this, so you talked about being a high school football or college football quarterback.
Yeah.
And you were in high school. I read that you did bands. You played in.
Well, I was in garage bands. Yeah.
Yeah.
I wanted to be a musician, singer. You know, in a band like Crosby, Stills, and Nash, or the Beach Boys, or Chicago. You know, that kind of thing.
And so, at some point, you end up on a stage as a comic instead. How did that happen?
Well, you know what? This might tie back to why I'm doing all this stuff, the editing and all that stuff myself for this hiking show, is because when I was in garage bands, you couldn't rely on anybody. They wouldn't show up. You know, we're all like 15, 14, 16 years old.
Right.
And, you know, you plan a practice, a rehearsal, somebody doesn't show up. And then eventually you go, I'm going to become an acoustic guitar player, a singer-songwriter, you know. So that's the direction I kind of went there. And but, you know, that doing that on stage was too intimate to me. It scared me. So comedy came more easily to me. And comedy, I was my own boss. You know, I didn't have to rely on anybody.
Right.
So that's why I think I do all that stuff for the hiking show. But
yeah.
Yeah.
But the first time you get on the stage, what sort of prompts you to say, I'm going to get on the stage and do comedy instead of do the singer?
Because I didn't want to do anything else. That's all I wanted to do. You know, I watched comics growing up. I would highlight their name in the TV Guide, George Miller, Letterman, whoever was on, Merv Griffin or whatever. That's how long I've been around.
Yeah.
And I would watch them. I would go and watch them. And I loved the craft of just going out on stage with no tools. Just
yeah.
A jack o' tire or whatever. And just doing jokes for 5 minutes and then leaving. And then you're off to work on the road. And that's kind of cool. I like that job.
It seems very cool. But I mean, for most of us, the thought of it is terrifying.
Well, it is at first, because I was that guy. I was that shy guy in school. I hated to get up in front of people. I still don't like to get in front of people unless they're in a comedy club and they're there because they come in to see comedy. They know it's me.
Yeah.
I mean, if I were to like have to like stand up in a group of like, you know, 30 people where we're, you know, kind of stranded in a warehouse because it's a hurricane and give a speech about, you know, I'd be a little nervous, you know.
That's a different kind of thing.
Yeah.
Tell me about the first time you got on the stage.
Well, it was a lead up. I moved out to LA from Connecticut, and I had a scroll of jokes I had written on typewriter paper, and I rolled it up and I, you know, memorized it. And I was staying on a friend's couch in Downey, California, and I would drive into Hollywood, and I knew the Improv had open mic night. So on Sunday nights I would drive there. For the first week I parked across the street and I watched as people walked in, went back to Downey. The next Sunday I went inside, but just stayed in the bar. I didn't go in the back room area because they might think I wanted to go on stage. You know, and so it was progressed like that until I finally went into the back room. And I put my name in the hat and they called my name and I looked around like everybody else was for Kevin Nealon. I didn't go up. And then the next time I went in, they called me like at 1:45 in the morning. There was two tables, drunks, and I went on and I did my jokes and I was hooked. But I was, every time after that, for a couple of years, I was terrified. I would be in the bathroom before I went on. I'd be pacing, thinking about it all day. You know, and I got through it. And now I'm so comfortable on stage. I feel like, you know, I could create a story on stage without even having any material.
Really? And yeah. Is it because you know the rhythms of telling stories or you can...
I know all that. I know what people are looking for. I know the other comics. I've watched comics. I know every style. I know, you know, there's a lot now I don't know because I don't live at the clubs like I used to. And there's a lot more, there's a, you know, big influx of comics now from all over the world. When I started, there was just comics from, you know, there were black comics, Jewish comics, Irish Catholic comics, you know, and a couple other whatever. But now it's just everyone, Iranian comics, Indian, Arabian, you know, from everywhere. And I can't possibly know everybody's act, but there was a time when my parents would come and I'd bring them to the comedy club, and my parents were pretty straight-laced. There was no swearing, you know, in my house. And whenever there was a dirty comic, I knew when that joke was coming up, I'd distract my parents. I'd say, hey, guys, do you want to go to the Chinese theater tomorrow? You know, and then we go back to watching because I know that dirty joke was over.
Wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, you grew up in like a Catholic...
Irish Catholic family in Connecticut. There's five kids. Yeah, my father was a helicopter executive. And we lived in Germany for 4 years because my father, his company had a contract with as he called it, a German outfit. For years, I thought it was Lederhosen, but no, it's a helicopter company. And it was great because we lived there for 4 years when I was 6 until I was 10. So I learned how to swim in Greece. I learned how to ski in the Alps. I learned how to argue in Italy. And it was a great experience back then because, you know, a lot of kids didn't travel that much. A lot of kids had never been on a plane.
Yeah.
And every show and tell, I would get those slides out of the Parthenon and, you know, the Eiffel Tower and show them. And even the teacher was amazed. Oh, you went there. Well, you know.
Right. That whole Irish Catholic upbringing thing, Catholic schools and all of that.
Yeah.
My friends who are Irish Catholic, you know, there's a lot of humor in the oppression of it all. That somehow that you know, growing up in this sort of, you know, going to church and being quiet, and there's this great desire to laugh, and a lot of their comedy comes from that. Did that influence the kind of humor or your choice of comedy?
Not so much.
As a
not
life?
So much for me. A little bit of that though, but you know, I zoned out in church whenever we went. My father brought us. My mother was Protestant, but my father would bring us, and we just sit there like, you know, most kids and just kind of daydream. And then we go home. But it was kind of a nice routine for us each week. We did as a family. But so I didn't feel that oppression or anything. You know, the Catholic school, you know, we had some of those, you know, priests, the fathers that would have a ruler and they'd hit you on the hand. But it wasn't that, you know, like you hear about some of these people. For me, most of my comedy came from, I guess, from being shy, you know.
Huh.
And I liked dark humor.
And the shyness, you would, what, in high school... Make your friends laugh.
Well, the problem was, Frank, that we moved around a lot. Like I said, we went to Germany for 4 years. You know, I was in two different schools over there. They're military schools, you know, on a military base.
Right.
And American schools, but on a military base.
I had those in Japan.
You did?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. So you know what it's like. Yeah. And so, you know, and then when I moved back to, you know, Connecticut, a couple of different schools because we were renting houses in different places. So I was never like part of a group in a school. I was always that outsider. Mm. You know, I'd come into the cafeteria as a new junior at this high school. I didn't know anybody. And so I ended up sitting with all the nerds where nobody talked the whole time. You just sat there.
Really? You would go sit down with these?
Because everybody else had their little cliques, you know, their tables, and there's no empty chairs. In hindsight, now I would go back there and say, move over, I'm sitting with you guys, you know.
That's just so heartbreaking, that image.
Well,
you,
but
like,
it made me who I am today.
And,
pardon me?
Yeah. Of you shuffling over with these kids and
yeah,
no one saying
but
anything.
But I did
to
feel safe with those kids, and I didn't care that they didn't talk. You know?
Huh. Yeah. And
I had great sandwiches that my mother made, you know?
But that's where the humor came. It started? Did it start later?
You know, it comes from all different places. You know, my family made it very easy to be funny. We took a lot of road trips. You know, there's a lot of us in the car.
Yeah.
Everybody's trying to outdo each other,
yeah.
You know, top each other with jokes and
right.
make our parents laugh. And so that was good. And my parents were also very supportive. You know, they would always laugh and, you know, really kind of make it feel like you had the funniest joke in the world. You know, whatever you did was funny. And I remember when I moved to Los Angeles, you know, I got a degree in marketing at a small business college in Connecticut, Sacred Heart University. So I had that to fall back on. And I come out here to do stand-up, and my parents never said anything. They were nervous, I learned later, but they were also very encouraging and supportive. And I remember being out here for about maybe 2 months, and I was running out of money. And I was doing manpower. I was working temporary jobs, you know. And I was sleeping on a friend's couch, another couch over in Hollywood. And I had enough gas money to get home or enough of rent for the first month rent on this crappy little apartment. And I was homesick. And I called my parents and I said, I don't know what to do. I miss you guys and I want to come home. Hmm. and I don't know whether to stay here or not, because I was trying comedy, I was doing the open mic nights, but, you know, it was still new to me. And my mother's very, you know, understanding and listening. And then my father got on the phone to talk to me, and I said, I don't know what to do, Dad. He goes, you're a big boy. Stay out there and do what you went out there to do. Give it a shot. Even though I knew he missed me, he wanted me to come home. That's wow. The kind of father he was.
That's amazing.
Oh, I still get teary when I think about that, because I wanted to go home.
Yeah.
But he said, stay. And I did. Now here I am with you, Frank.
But it is an amazing thing. And you hear frequently when you talk to comics the other story, which is, I came from a horrible family.
Yeah.
Things were not great. All of my comedy comes from pain. You had a great family.
I did. And I feel for those people. And it's a whole different style of comedy, I think.
Yeah. And look at you now.
I know. A lot of times I pinch myself. And I say, this is what you wanted.
Yeah.
Be careful what you wish for. You
right.
know?
No, but I mean, you've done it all. You know, the height of stardom, TV, movies. Now you're transitioning to this YouTube thing. You're still, touring
all over the country.
I'm very comfortable
and very happy. Yeah, I have a nice family. And, I just moved into a new home. That comedy got me. Jokes got me.
Yeah.
You know?
What do you want to do next? Obviously, this hiking with Kevin is fantastic.
I want to learn how to balance my life more and not be, as my wife says, a workaholic, which I don't think I am, but because I have friends that are really workaholics. But I just want to, spend a lot of time with my son.
Yeah.
And my wife, and just kind of do fun things.
How old is your son?
Oh, he must be about 12 by now. See, I'm never home. Yeah, he's 12.
And what would you say to him about comedy in terms of, Dad, I think I want to be a comic.
Well,
at what point is that okay for him to take that path? Or, Dad, you do that TV thing.
Yeah.
You're in the movies. I want to do that, and I'm 12 years old.
Right.
When he says that to you, or if he says that to you, what do you say?
I say, great. If you love doing it, do it. I think the hardest thing is for someone to find their passion.
Hmm.
There's some people out there that don't have a passion.
Yeah.
You know, they don't know what they want, what they like, and I feel bad for them, because they go in, they do a job. It may be mundane, or maybe they like it, but, they get their paycheck, they come home, and it's, they get the two-week vacation, whatever, and that's fine for a lot of people. That's great. I'm not knocking that. But I'm just saying, but if you have a passion, something you really enjoy doing, and you can make a living doing it, what a great life.
Yeah. If Dad had said to you, you know what, you're right, it's over, come on back home.
Like that, I would have been home.
Really?
Yeah.
And where would you be now?
Probably in advertising.
That would have been it. I mean,
I don't know. Maybe I would have come back. I would have come back. Maybe. I don't know.
Yeah. Well, Kevin, I'm sure glad that you stayed in it, and I know that millions of other people feel the same way.
Thank you, Frank. I'm certainly glad I stayed in it.
Thanks for the years of just laughter.
My pleasure.
Every time you come on the program, you're one of our favorites.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
So thanks very much.
My pleasure.
All right, my friend. If you'd like to see my conversation with Kevin, including some clips from Hiking with Kevin, check out Frank Buckley interviews on KTLA this weekend, or watch us on YouTube. Just search for Frank Buckley Interviews, Kevin Nealon. I enjoy reading your feedback on social media. Tag me at Frank Buckley TV on Twitter and on Instagram, or post a comment on my Facebook page. We drop a new podcast every Wednesday. Of course, it's always free to listen. Thanks for listening today, and until next time, I'll see you on TV.